This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. My name is Najwa Mayar. I'm a Society of Fellows postdoctoral scholar at Boston University and your host today. I'm joined by Dr. Salar Mameni, an art historian, artist, and assistant professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. We will be discussing their new book, Terracine, A Crude Aesthetics, published in August 2023 with Duke University Press. Terracine theorizes the historical conjuncture of two ideas. One, the emergence of the Anthropocene as a scientific concept, which names a new geological age of the human as well as human-made industrialization. And two, the 21st century war on terror, which names a geopolitical age of Western-led global war within and on the planet. Terracine ultimately reveals the historically entwined relationships between climate change and war, as well as their uneven distributions across the world. Mameni explores these relationships by studying the Anthropocene from below, focusing on the effects of war and climate change on racialized humans, non-humans, and environments within West Asian petroleum economies. The book turns to aesthetics and the sensorial as its archive, examining how the Anthropocene is known and felt from those lands and life forms enveloped by racialized militarism and militarized sciences, including regions like Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Palestine. Terracine's archive includes visual and sound artworks, Islamic and indigenous cosmologies, as well as self-reflexive moments of memoir, all the while theorizing non-hierarchical modes of knowledge and a methodology of the senses.
Hey, hi, Salar. I'm happy to be in conversation with you and to celebrate this extraordinary book.
Hello, Najwa. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So the tradition at New Books Network is to begin with learning about the author's journey toward their project. So will you please introduce yourself as well as your path to the academy and to this book?
Sure. So my name is Salar Mameni. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Ethnic Studies at UC Berkeley. I am an art historian. So my journey to ethnic studies is one that kind of goes through many different disciplines and many different kind of areas of questioning and engagement with art, but also with many other disciplines. I think as people of color in the US, we all end up thinking in interdisciplinary ways because we have lived intersectional and interdisciplinary lives. And so I came into academia through art practice. So I did my undergraduate work in art practice, and then I went into art history. So I did an MA degree and a PhD degree in art history. And while I was, doing art history, I found myself gravitating towards ethnic studies, which, you know, as someone who hadn't been educated in the U.S. prior to a PhD program, I was unfamiliar with ethnic studies as a discipline. But I soon learned that, so much excellent work in critical race theory, in gender and sexuality studies, in indigenous studies, and in, you know, various other kinds of ethnic formations happen in ethnic studies in the U.S. And so I found that questions that were asked in ethnic studies by ethnic studies scholars and students were not the same questions that I was confronting in art history, which was my home discipline. So the book really is an attempt at, kind of bringing all of these different educational, trajectories into thinking about the topic of the book, which is, separate from these different disciplines, but I find that is answered and questioned in different ways in these different disciplines.
Thank you. So let's dig into the book a bit. So your book reflects on the historical conjuncture of two ideas. So one is the emergence of the Anthropocene as a scientific concept, which names a kind of new geological age of the human, as well as human-made industrialization. And then the second is the global war on terror, which names a geopolitical age of so-called terrorism and marks yet another Western waged war within and on the planet. So you conceive a term in analytic to think through these two kind of interbedded epistemic moments, terracine, which you describe as quote, a world in which the effects of war and climate change are inseparable, end quote. So will you unpack this term for us, as well as what, who, and when the terracine marks?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. So the Anthropocene discourse is quite large. And when I started to engage with the Anthropocene discourse, the very first thing that stood out to me was how the concept itself is rarely historicized. And so when you think about the emergence of the notion of the Anthropocene, which you just defined as, a concept that tells us about the way that the earth is shaped by humans, so by the anthropos, that concept was proposed at around the same time as the war on terror was beginning. And so one of my interests was to historicize the concept of the Anthropocene. So to ask, why was it coined in the early years of the 20th century? Why was it popularized in that moment? And in relation to what? And so I began to think about the Anthropocene and the war on terror together. And a lot of things result with that. You know, I have a whole book worth of answers to what happens when you put these two ideas together. But some main things to point out are the Anthropocene proposes a kind of an antagonist, right? So the human who has made an intervention in the geology of the earth, in how we think about climate change, and how we think about the way that the earth changes in relation to the humans that are existing within it and our interactions with the planet itself. The war on terror also proposes a particular kind of an antagonist. And that antagonist is just as ambiguous as the Anthropocene is the notion of terror or the terrorist. And the terrorists, as you know, we all are aware, settle on particular peoples and places and objects, but in essence, it's a very ambiguous concept that kind of points to a particular antagonist. So what happens though when you think about these two concepts together is that you find that the terrorist ends up also being an antagonist towards the anthropos. And so I found that the notion of the terrorist was a racializing concept that was actually not included within the concept of the human, within how the human was theorized by scientists who were looking at climate change. So that's, one kind of trajectory of thought when we historicize the notion of the Anthropocene. The other one, of course, is that, the war on terror doesn't just think about terror, but it also is a military concept, right? So it is a way of going into war against a particular enemy. And so when we think about these two concepts together, you know, the second thing I highlight is how the Anthropocene as an idea is itself militarized. So it's not just that it's a racializing concept, that it pushes the terrorists outside of the concept of the human, but also it wages a particular war against this, you know, this kind of outside category, which is the terrorist. So as a military concept, and that's something that not too many scientists propose. They don't think of the Anthropocene as a militarized and military concept. But, you know, I show in the book how it becomes that in many different ways. And, you know, to answer kind of the last part of your question, which is, you know, who is indicated by the notion of the terrorist scene? When does it begin? Where does it originate? And where is it now? I was really interested in proposing the concept of the terrorist scene as a way of thinking about historiography in general. So, you know, the Anthropocene proposes a particular way of thinking history, right? So there are specific benchmarks to, you know, when the Anthropocene begins. And of course, scientists have very different ideas about when it begins. Some date it as far back as, you know, early settlements in Mesopotamia, some dated to the 19th century, some dated to Industrial Revolution, some, you know, mark it to the kind of explosion of the first atomic bomb. So there are disagreements in terms of when the Anthropocene actually begins. So with the terrorist scene, I wasn't so concerned about, you know, getting into this kind of periodization, you know, as a practice, but I was more interested in thinking about how the terrorist scene kind of functions today. So what does it mean to think about the Anthropocene as a concept that's proposed to deal with climate change in a moment where military interventions on the globe are actually changing the climate a lot more than, what the notion of the Anthropocene might, assign to, say, human settlement in a particular moment. So those were some of the kind of central ideas in theorizing the terrorist scene.
Thank you so much. I mean, this is so rich, and I would love to continue developing the way in which you bring these two literatures together, the Anthropocene and the War on Terror, through among other things, a critique of militarism. So you've told us that you offer the terrorist scene, as in your words, a rebuttal to the scientific notion of the Anthropocene as an imperial, Eurocentric and anthropocentric idea and project, which, as you've just described, at once homogenizes the human and the world while disguising climate change's unequal distribution of violence and risk in that world. So now at the same time, terracing contributes a really expansive and ecological intervention within critiques of counterterrorism and the terrorist itself in War on Terror literature. So can you speak to this kind of double move within these two bodies of literature that aren't usually in conversation? In other words, can you tell us about the relations you draw, as you say, between terra, terrans, and terror within the terra scene?
Yeah. Thank you for that. So when we begin to think about terror as a concept, and, you know, when I started to look at terror and how ambiguous that term is, I realized that, you know, terror is linked to the idea of territory, right? So territory is, a notion of settlement, a notion of, Thinking about land not as, a place of habitation for multi-species organisms, but as something that's bordered off for humans. So the trafficking between terror and territory was really interesting. And on top of that, the notion of terra, which is the earth. And, you know, obviously climate change is, or the Anthropocene is a concept that puts pressure on how we engage with terra, so with the earth, and what are some of the effects that humans have on the earth? So for me, this third notion, which is territorialization, was the linkage between terra and territory. And so I drew a lot on indigenous studies to kind of try to think about what it means to have a land-based theoretical perspective, but also how do we think placement and displacement in relation to war, right? So displacement is not always a theory of migration. Displacement can also be thought of as a theory of erasure. So what happens when peoples and other multi-species habitations become destroyed, through climate change and war, when they kind of basically get erased from the bottom of people's, feet. A part of the project was to, think about that kind of, form of displacement, and then what happens to, peoples and things that remain. In terms of the idea of, counterinsurgency, I was interested in thinking about, the designation of terror, what counts as terror. So I give, multiple examples that are not just people, but things such as, viruses, areas that have, mines embedded within them that have, lands that have become weapons basically far into the future after wars have ended. So actually looking at, the detritus of climate change, the kind of waste that is left after wars, but also the effects of climate change, and to kind of think about these, these things as creating basically peoples and habitats, right? That then they all become designated as sites of terror. And then they become pressurized by, surveillance practices and military as, danger zones, right? As areas that can be viral, for example, or that can, affect other things. And so they become hyper surveilled and bordered off. And so there's a particular kind of geography of terror that gets produced through these multi-pronged practices.
Thank you. This may be an obvious point, but I think it's worth mentioning because it's really well theorized in the text, is that terracine as a word is not just kind of etymological experimentation, but you also reflect on how language acts as an epistemic archive for experiencing the world as it changes. And one of my favorite sections, one of my many favorite sections in the book, is a really moving one where you discuss through the work of the artist collective, is it the Bureau of Linguistical Reality? How we are faced with kind of new conditions for which we need new words. And as you suggest, this is not a novel condition, but it is made kind of more challenging for something so overwhelming and not really decipherable to the human perspective, like the Anthropocene.
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm interested in words. I'm interested in how they signify, but also I think, as multilingual speakers, we all kind of feel the limitations of words. You know, they tend to fail. And as someone who was trained as a visual artist before I was a writer, I also find words to be quite daunting when I have to work with them. But also, I think, you know, the term Anthropocene has bothered, you know, so many different kinds of scholars, because it centers, you know, not just like the notion of the anthropos, but also the very Eurocentric way that it resonates. So, you know, how is the human defined, right? Who is the human? Who does it signify? And so, you know, one thing that I wish I could have done in the book was to work with non-English words. So I think Terracine is very evocative of what I want to theorize, but at the same time, I am myself dismayed by the fact that it is still using, you know, a kind of Latin base for language to express those ideas. So, you know, something that I hope I can do in the future, and that I find interesting in the work that you're mentioning here is, you know, using kind of root words from different languages, from our own kind of native languages, in my case, Farsi and Arabic, to build worlds, to, you know, to kind of define words, define worlds in ways that are not always limited to the kind of Eurolinguistic framework, because that ends up taking over in terms of its, you know, epistemic reach.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to return to this point about the kind of situatedness within kind of regimes of power of the Anthropocene, and also the kind of limitations of the academic form. But just to build the book's architecture a little bit more for the listeners, you situate your critique within a particular site of research, petroleum economies in West Asia. So can you describe the setting and how it exemplifies the Terracene?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the very early versions of the book dealt a lot with oil before I, you know, had a different kind of framework to work with. So, and that, you know, a part of it was related to my own kind of biographical, you know, personhood, I guess, and, you know, having grown up in Iran, and really, you know, I think when we think colonialism and imperialism in the context of the region, oil figures really drastically. And so for me to think with the geopolitical and the geological nature of the region, it was inescapable to, you know, center petroleum and, you know, its various kind of carbon-related modes. And of course, you know, there had been many theorists who had been thinking about, you know, carbon democracies, et cetera. So I was interested in thinking about, you know, what the Earth itself designated or had us theorize with. And, you know, when I began to look into not just the work of artists who had been working with oil in the region, but also doing some, you know, research into what oil actually meant in the region before it was routed into the petroleum and extractive industries. You know, what work did it do in the region? What became really clear was its kind of sacred status. So, in the context of Iran, obviously the kind of Zoroastrian religious concepts dealt a lot with fires, and fires that were kept going for years on end because of the petroleum seepages that were already on the surface and available in certain areas in the region. So, the link between oil and spiritual and religious thought was really fascinating to me, because it enabled a very different way of engaging with Terrans than the petroleum extractive industry did. And so, I started to also find linkages with other, indigenous relations to oil. And I mention some of those in the book, in North America and elsewhere. So it really provided for me a way of thinking with the earth itself, a way of thinking with how oil itself might theorize, in a way that other concepts from, from the top down would not offer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, and that's a really intriguing part of the book. And maybe we'll hear more about this in later questions, the ways in which petroleum itself is a kind of living character in the book. And, at some points, oil is a narrator, oil is a theorist, as you just said, an aesthetic. So related to that, the kind of driving inquiry of this book is not only how do we think and know the Anthropocene from its points of ravage, but also how do we sense it? So will you discuss the sensorial as a kind of embodied mode of knowledge, and how you engage sensorial knowledges in this book, particularly through autobiography and, as you've just shared, as an artist through artworks?
Yeah, so maybe I can keep talking about petroleum in relation to that for a second. One interest that I had while writing the book was thinking with the senses for a number of reasons. So first was this question around petroleum. What does it mean to think aesthetics outside of the human? So if I'm theorizing, a different genre of the human. So if, the anthropos is a particular Eurocentric being, and that there are other ways of being human and theorizing human, how might we do that through aesthetic theory, which also really focused on the human as the only sentient being, right? And so one of my questions was, how do we do aesthetic theory through the senses of more than human beings? And so I zero in on petroleum as a site of exploration for this question. And I do a number of things. So one of them is I look at, for example, explosions at oil extraction sites where, oil is doing a lot of work, right? It's getting the workers at the site to stay away. It's, it's announcing itself in this kind of, toxic way that puts the bodies of the workers in danger. Asking a particular thing of the humans that are occupying that space. And so I read the agency of oil when it comes to oil extraction as a mode of refusal. So I talk about petro refusal in the book, where if the human is engaging with oil in this moment only in an extractive manner, which is radically different than, historically how humans were interacting with oil in this region, as I said, in a spiritual way, how is oil itself reacting to that? How is it reacting to this new mode of engagement with it? And So I read, you know, explosions as a form of protest, as a form of, you know, not asking humans not to extract it, not to pull it outside of the earth in the kind of way that it's being done in industrial modes. So that is, you know, one way of shifting to the sentience of petroleum and thinking with its, you know, aesthetic way of inhabiting the world. The other reason why I was really interested in thinking with aesthetics was, you know, not just because I'm an art historian, but also because theories of the Anthropocene often discuss the limitation of knowing. So when we think climate change, as humans, it's very difficult to experience climate change because its time period is very long. You know, you have to engage with deep time, and deep time is a concept which means a time before historical time. So before we had written texts, for example. So deep time is, you know, a time, it's an imagined time in a sense, it's a geological time before human intervention. So when we think with deep time, when we think with collective concepts such as the human species, for example, these are all, you know, scientific proposals for thinking the Anthropocene, and they're very conceptual and they're very abstract. So there is a limit to experiencing them. And so that's, you know, often proposed as a problem in Anthropocene discourse. And so my interest was to think with aesthetics, to kind of offer a way to, you know, think through the senses that was engaging the world, I guess, you know, differently than a scientific concept might. So aesthetics was a way of bringing a different disciplinary thought system into how science normally theorizes the Anthropocene. And I found it to be quite productive in that sense. Was there another part to your question that maybe I'm not answering?
No, well, if you want to add also, I mean, you're also using your own senses. There's quite a bit of memoir here.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, so, you know, when we think about aesthetics, we always, I guess, in a sense, have to center our own experiences because the notion of aesthetics asks you to do that. You know, the other twist, I guess, in the book is where I begin to think about, you know, what it means to sense when you have experienced war, which is, you know, my kind of biographical entry into this. And when you, you know, live under aerial bombardments or other kinds of, you know, modern industrial warfare, your senses become quite fatigued, if not injured, if not, you know, traumatized in a particular way. And so for me, as I describe in the book, there is a difference between how aesthetic theory thinks the senses and how, you know, a traumatized, injured veteran of a war thinks the senses. And the kind of major difference is that aesthetic theory takes the organs of the body that can sense for granted. Whereas when we think with injured organs, when we think with, you know, traumatic effects of war through sound, you know, through heavy sound that can shatter your ears, but also like other organs through vibration, we, you know, realize that theories of trauma kind of overlook what, you know, what aesthetics can do. So they offer different ways of being immersed perhaps in a kind of violent setting that can rupture your senses, your organs. So that was a conceptual impasse that I found, you know, the incongruency, I guess, between aesthetic theory and trauma. So that was really for me a way of then providing a rebuttal to how aesthetic theory has normally engaged with both Anthropocene and war. You know, I found that so many theorists had used concepts such as, for example, the sublime to talk about both the war and terror, but also the Anthropocene, because it conveyed a sense of awe. You know, that a person was in awe of what was happening, something that was beyond them, something that was bigger than them. And for me, that was just not going to work. I felt that, you know, ideas such as the sublime were just not getting at the point, because they always imagined a human that was standing at a distance from the event that was happening, and was this kind of a voyeur observer of, you know, this this immense event. Whereas if we're going to think with the terror scene, we are embedded within, you know, not just like toxic environments and aftermaths of war, but also, you know, we're embedded in a, you know, category or a region that's, you know, bordered off and under surveillance. So there is no distance, there is no standing apart and looking at, you know, at an event. So I offer, you know, different ways of engaging the senses that are, I find, more relevant to theories of the terror scene.
Thank you. I mean, the aesthetics of the sublime are also like key to envisaging kind of Western colonial expansionism, right? So American landscape painting. I think for academics thinking and teaching with this book, there are like several instances where you trace these kinds of formative conjunctures between aesthetics and war that are really important to wrestle with as kind of consumers of culture within economies of forever war. So even though I think you addressed most of this question, I want to maybe develop it a little bit more to think about aesthetic theory. What does it traditionally look like? Because your sort of engagement with the multisensorial is also a principled critique of hierarchies of knowledge within Western academic tradition. So will you elaborate on this? So one, the kind of stratification of the senses within aesthetic theory, but also you talk about the kind of dichotomous professionalization of the artist versus the scientist.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, really quickly, aesthetic theory has a hierarchy of senses. So the senses that are described as distantiating senses, so the sense of seeing and the sense of hearing, are at the apex of that hierarchy, because they don't approach or get entangled with the object of perception. So you can see something while standing afar, or hear something while standing afar, while the other senses, such as the sense of smell and taste, and certainly the sense of touch, are called proximal senses, because you are in close contact with the object that you're experiencing and sensing, but also you might be completely entangled with it, such as the sense of smell. In the book, I think a lot with toxicity, because of you know, oil and other kinds of warfare. And, you know, toxicity is not something that is usually registered on the senses in the context of aesthetic theory, because it falls really low on that register of hierarchies, and, you know, to a point where it's not even understood as an aesthetic experience. And so I wanted to question, you know, what counts as an aesthetic experience and what doesn't count as an aesthetic experience. The other thing that aesthetic theory does is that it relies on what it calls the sensus communis. So in order for something to be perceived as an aesthetic experience, it has to be shared. It has to be a shared understanding. And so the notion of difference, the notion of being not just differently situated, but also having different organs that can sense at different stages of health/injury, that can, really disrupt how the sensus communis traditionally works as a concept. So the minute I think, a war-torn, person of color begins to think aesthetic theory, the whole system of aesthetic theory inevitably falls apart because it can't actually address the lived experiences of that person because aesthetic theory didn't have that person in mind. So I think, it's less of a rebellious move and more of a like, what happens when the non-traditional person begins to theorize and the discipline ends up falling apart as a result because the discipline doesn't have that person in mind. So, and I think that's what kind of comes into this question, this other question that you're asking around knowledge formation, disciplinary knowledge formation, academic knowledge formation, et cetera. One place to begin, which is, the place that your question is beginning is that distinction between the artist and the scientist. For me, as someone who has been an artist and who's an art historian, coming into a scientific concept, I felt that, I had a very different perspective when it came to the same questions that a scientist might ask. And so I began to think about, the practice of being an artist versus the practice of being a scientist. And, obviously I found that the notion of the scientist is a lot more recent than the notion of the artist. So the very disciplinary formation of science that centers a scientist is one that excludes other knowledge producers that might mean, artists, but it might also mean religious scholars. It might also mean people who are, engaging with the world through other gendered embodiments. So the very concept of the scientist is an exclusionary concept. And when we begin to bring all these other, knowledge formations into the practice of science, it disintegrates the notion of the scientist because it can't hold. So there is a section in the book where I go into detail about, how the Anthropocene scientists understood their own discipline in relation to Galileo. And then I read Galileo as an artist. So basically kind of undo that historiography of a scientist who remains a scientist, but then I read, a scientist who becomes an actual artist. So that's one way of answering your question.
Thank you. So I was going to ask you about this, the kind of presumptive viewer of aesthetic theory. So I'll since you answered that so well, I'll maybe shift this question a little bit. So this book provides a robust theory of perception. It relatedly provides kind of situated critiques of perspective. As you've noted, you reckon with the kind of Eurocentric, anthropocentric, masculinist, ableist, racialized, and other kinds of imperial perspectives of Western knowledge traditions, ranging the sciences, the secular, and aesthetic theory, among others. So you are playing you kind of bring together the scientist and the artist, and you're playing with the kind of scene and Anthropocene and Terracene as both kind of a geotemporal marker, so C-E-N-E, and a visual field, S-C-E-N-E. So I think openly, like, what perspectives do we acquire by examining the Anthropocene, as you say, as a work of art?
Right. I don't think it's, you know, much of a stretch to think about the Anthropocene as a work of art. The very scientific theory of the Anthropocene basically proposes a planet that has been sculpted by humans into an artificial, kind of existence. And so it is, it's not, a stretch to think of the Anthropocene as a work of art. One place that I go with that in the book is to then propose that, that perhaps the scientist is this very artist, right, who has, through industrialization, actually brought the Anthropocene into being. So I think that is a controversial claim, perhaps for a scientist, because, the tradition of, or the discourse of the Anthropocene is to place the scientist as a person who is there to help us get out of the Anthropocene, right? So it says, here we are, we're going to give you, different tools to get us out of this situation that we're in. And so for me, the question was, well, why is it that, the scientist, who is a particularly defined person, who is a particularly Eurocentric industrialist human of a particular genre, who has gotten us into this situation to begin with, why is it that that person is also the person who is going to give us the solutions? And so it was a, so it's a pitch for thinking outside of the domain of science for the kinds of answers that we need today. So the perspective, I guess, that I offer is, one that asks us to look elsewhere, to think with other knowledge producers, to think with, other ways of engaging the earth that already existed, that continues to exist outside of the hegemony of science, which positions itself as the only rational way of engaging the planet. And of course, the introduction to the book, or rather the preface of the book, begins with a claim for, or rather a limitation of rationality when it comes to thinking with climate change. So I offer, an episode from an Islamic manuscript, and I think with a creation story, an Islamic creation story, as a way of proposing the limits of rationality, because that image is a provocative image that gives us a different idea of balance, gives us a different idea of how the world holds up and where we are in relation to our imagined planet and the world at large. So I think the scientist is not just a problem, I think, for me in relation to art and aesthetic theory and creative practice, but also in relation to the multiple ways of thinking religiously across different cultures, which science very much kind of pushes to the periphery of thought systems.
I'd love to talk about some of these thought systems. I'm on this last point, I'm really interested in how you interrogate the secular as a modern, scientific, and masterful sensibility imbricated in the kind of homogenizing narrative of the Anthropocene. So will you discuss a bit more how you resource these kinds of Islamic, also pre-Islamic, and other ancient and indigenous cosmologies, which have like long narrated and sensed the world against this kind of entrenched secularity of Western Academy?
I think philosophers of religion, are very good at telling us that, secularism is only meaningful when it positions itself against religion, right? So secularism comes into being as in opposition with religion. So in a way, it produces religion. You know, for me, these dichotomies are not useful. And so so I wanted to think with religious thought. And as you say, you know, some of my material that I offer in the book are pre-Islamic because of the region that I'm working with. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think about, you know, various gods, ancient Mesopotamian gods that, you know, can help us think with climate change, so with temperatures, that can help us think with, you know, petroleum, that can help us think about, you know, winds and viruses, et cetera. So these are some of the, you know, kind of polymorphous gods that appear in the book. But then I also think with Islam as a religion that, you know, has obviously a different history. It's a monotheistic religion, but it's also very syncretic in particular areas that I'm looking at. And it incorporates some of these pre-Islamic notions of deities into its system. And so, you know, I'm also like not being very rigid about how I define, you know, pre-Islamic religions and Islam. But anyway, so I kind of go to these religions to think about, you know, how basically the you know, the earth is imagined in relation to humans. That's very different from the secular notion of thinking the planet. So in the secular notion, which is kind of what we're dealing with extractive economies and militarism, the earth is a resource. It's a place to you know, extract resources for the human, with the human in mind, and also, you know, to kind of dump waste. Whereas when we think with Islam and when we think with pre-Islamic traditions, the earth is sacred, right? So it is not there for the human. So, and you know, some of this stuff doesn't come into the book, but in Islamic thought, I mean, some of it does come into the book. The world is not built for the human, right? So there are you know, multi species, including mountains and trees and flowers, all, you know, in various verses of the Quran, all prostrate towards Allah and give their worship, you know, at all times. And so there is a difference in how the world is imagined in relation to the human. So that, you know, image that I start the book with that I mentioned earlier is an image where the human doesn't actually feature in the creation story. So the human is decentered, various elements of the world are held up on the wings of an angel, which, you know, gives us this notion of the sacred world. So how do we relate to a sacred world is very different than how we might relate to a world that's built for us and for the satisfaction of our needs in terms of resources.
Thank you. I mean, it seems to me it's also, and not just an important intellectual decision, but a political decision to think with Islam in a book about sort of post-colonial, neo-colonial extraction economies in West Asia. I mean, given Islam is a body of knowledge that is particularly marginalized within the academy's tradition of the secular, and really its privileging of a Western Christian tradition of the secular, as well as in this moment within the kind of like secular disciplinary regimes of the war on terror. So I I have to also take a moment to say this is a really beautiful book. And I don't even know if beautiful is the right word when you're writing about, like, when what you're writing about like is the slowly and violently emerging end of a world and the kind of unequal distribution of that violent ending. And your book really made me reckon with my own kind of sensorial relationship to how we aestheticize academic critiques of violence. but having said that, the theorizing is really stunning, the language is arresting, and the kind of intentional play with the academic form is refreshing. So may I ask your thoughts about the aesthetics of the academic form and its possible limitations when dealing with the kind of epistemic and existential conditions that you're theorizing here? So that is climate change, war, and a de-exceptionalization of the human.
Yeah, thank you for that question. yeah, academic form. So, you know, like I said, I come into academia as an artist. And so, I try to bring, you know, all of me and not, you know, border off parts of me for the sake of academic discourse. And so, yeah, you know, I think there's a lot that the academic genre cannot do, right? And, you know, there's a lot it can do, there's a lot it cannot do. And so I... one thing that I ended up doing later on in the production of the book was to cut it into small sections. So that's one form that you might notice, you know, when looking at the book. There are chapters that are just 2 pages. There are, you know, sections that are just an image. So it doesn't follow the format of chapters. It doesn't follow the format of, you know, kind of beginning with a thesis and ending with a conclusion. It kind of intervenes into those demands of the academic voice. So I insert drawings that are my own, which I don't analyze in language. Some of them I do, some of them I don't. There are, so that's, you know, another way of engaging with these questions through drawing. I also, you know, as you mentioned, provide certain anecdotes, which, you know, to me is not just a way of positioning myself, because certainly it positions myself as a person, but it's also a way of, you know, telling the reader something about my own education as a person in the world, because academia is not the only place where we learn things, right? There's learning happening all the time. We have a lot of knowledges within us. And so, you know, one thing that I tried to resist was to limiting my own embodied knowledges to what I learned in a formal educational setting. So that's another, I guess, intervention that happens in the book, where I try to honor other forms of learning. So, you know, what did I learn aesthetically growing up during the war, for example, or what do I learn aesthetically when, you know, as a person from the region, I am perceived as a terrorist, you know, and I'm, you know, my movement is limited across borders, for example, or, you know, what do I learn as a person who has internalized certain kinds of phobias and racisms, and, you know, a person who is within a culture, frankly, that is extremely Islamophobic, right? So as a Muslim who is constantly navigating Islamophobia, it's, you know, there's a particular learning that happens there. And to bring that knowledge into academic writing, I think, is very important, because these are ways that we, you know, confront the world, learn from the world, but also, you know, they become, I think it's our ethical responsibility to theorize through those knowledges. And, you know, as you mentioned, Islam figures in a particular way today, not just in academia, but in the world in general. I think, it's linked with terrorism in a way that it doesn't have to be. There is nothing inherently terrorist about Islam, but we all know that it's linked in that particular way. And so unentangling these associations take a lot of work. And I think when you live that experience, it can be overwhelming. It can be really heavy. It can be difficult to disentangle these things. But you also, I think, carry within you a particular perspective when it comes to that. And so I think those are ways really that I bring myself into academic writing and academic practice, because, you know, what is academic writing and academic practice? It doesn't exist outside of us as a people. And if we don't bring our personhood into it, I think it's adhering to this kind of abstract sense of what that is and ossifying it in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I mean, I just kind of want to sit with that. This book really is a gorgeous model for, like, both theorizing syncretically with Islam and also a model for breaking with the academic form, which I certainly learned from it as somebody who's not quite brave with my experimentation with the academic form. But we're coming towards the end of our time. I read this book within the last couple of months. We all read within and through our moments. So I thought we could conclude by thinking about this moment. So we are recording this episode in the sixth month of Israel's ongoing genocide campaign in Palestine. We are over two decades into this century's iteration of the war on terror and multiple centuries into a militarized racial colonial modernity. This book and the diaspora artists it thinks with, from your reading of Syrian artist Diana Al-Hadid's sculptural representations of maiming and trauma to Palestinian artist Larissa Sansour's visualization of, like, long ecologies of war, provide ever urgent demands to demilitarize and decolonize, because very literally the world depends on it. Will you discuss the terror scene as a political lesson for this moment?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think the term you're using, demilitarization, is key. I think I would love to live in a world that's demilitarized, and every day I see the opposite. In this very particular moment, we are seeing a heightened genocide against the people in Palestine who, their entire livelihood, as we have seen over and over, their access to food, to water, to, just living, has been cut off by the Israeli military. And so I think encountering that generation after generation after generation takes a toll on, huge populations. So I think one thing about the terror scene to sit with and to think with is the longevity of military projects. So how long do they last in the future? What kinds of futures they imagine? What kinds of futures they disallow? Militarization doesn't end today, right? It kind of, like, imagines a particular future. And, something I mention in the book is this notion of settler futurity. So, how the region is imagined far into the future. And at this moment, there is a particular kind of, Israeli settler futurity that's being, very kind of ostensibly pushed, basically, or produced through militarization and all of its rhetorics in the media and policing of dissent. And so, I think one of the important things for me is to think with what militarization does for thinking futures. How does it prevent the livelihood of not just, you know, people who are experiencing war, but of the planet at large. What does it do to the planet and to the people and other living organisms in it? So I think, you know, climate change has a lot of traction. There are a lot of people who are mobilized and who are, you know, compelled by the notion of climate change. And so I hope that the book and the idea of the Terracene is going to compel the same level of attention and the same level of mobilization around demilitarization.
Thank you. Thank you for those powerful and pressing comments. And thank you for this tremendous book, which I encourage everyone to read, to think with, to teach with, and to mobilize with. Terracene is available with Duke University Press.